this won't keep you still. I love you, baby. Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Oh, Barry White. And a little bit of I'm Gonna Love You Just a Little Bit More. We're going to talk about when love goes just that little bit more or a lot more on films tonight, and about sex in films, because we've done space films, we've done films about older people, we've done great baddies, we've done all sorts of things on nightlife, but we haven't done films that are very sexy, and let's face it, sex sells. But you know, sexy films involve a level of vulnerability and possibly power play, and I just can't imagine as an actor even attempting to do one. So CJ Johnson knows all about all types of films, including sexy films. Are you a big sexy film fan? Such a bad way of talking about it.
No.
Sexy films.
Well, the way I've thought of it, good evening, by the way.
Hi.
I've titled my little note sheet as erotic mainstream cinema.
Okay.
Because we're just not talking about porn, obviously.
Yeah.
So
EMC.
Yeah. So we're talking about erotic mainstream cinema, and I guess by that, films that are released to the general public, not the porn-going public. Not that there is a porn-going public anymore, I suppose. That has all gone into our homes now. But I think we all know what we're talking about. So films whereby sex is the predominant, I suppose, marketing angle for the film. You know, if you think about The Godfather, you either think family drama or you think crime drama. When you think of Jaws, you think shark drama, maybe horror film, etc. But when you think of a film, for example, such as Last Tango in Paris or 9½ Weeks, what you think of first is an erotic film.
Yep.
And so that's how we're sort of going.
Okay,
with it.
We should do Killer Animals one week, one Saturday night.
How many killer? I suppose.
There's so many.
I guess there are quite a lot of, you know, there's Jaws, which is the obviously the king of killer animal movies. And then there's probably like 38 million bad killer animal
movies.
It'd
be a really fun one.
That
anyway,
let's do that.
Let's stay on topic.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's amazing really that there's not more, because sex sells, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. This to me is the great conflict about the whole erotic mainstream cinema vibe, is that essentially since the very dawn of cinema, they knew straight off the bat, everyone who was making movies knew straight off the bat that the best thing they could possibly show in their films was sexually related content, because that would be what people wanted to see most, because it's what people have always wanted the most. You know, people weren't going to flock to the cinema to see a train arriving at the station over and over again.
Wasn't a train going through a tunnel the euphemism for what they meant in a sex scene?
Famously Hitchcock, in one of the Hitchcocks, famously invented that trope, which has then been parodied a million times. You know, that's a really good one, isn't it? Yeah. Hitchcock had so many little jokes like that for the sexual moment. But yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, we've always known that people want, besides, I suppose, to have sex in their daily lives, but to see representations of sex, there have always been erotic novels, there have always been erotic magazines, there have always been all sorts of erotica as literary things. And so now we have this visual medium. I mean, there were always erotic paintings. The nude always has been the most painted thing in the entire world, is the nude.
Yeah.
You know, you got your apples, your landscapes above it all, you're nude. And so it was a natural for the cinema to show. And for a while, as we've discussed on different programs, so we don't need to go down there too heavily right now, but for a while, cinema was essentially unregulated, kind of like the early days of the internet, kind of like the first 10, 15 years of Facebook, you know, because it was so new, it took a long time for regulators within any governments to catch up to it. And I would suspect at first also, people were so just delighted by what they were seeing that they felt no need, you know, everyone wanted it, you know, let's not trammel this amazing thing before it gets going.
So were early films super sexy?
Well, they were more sexy than they then were for about the next 30 or 40 years.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, in the United States, as Hollywood started getting extremely wealthy, extremely powerful, but still was showing whatever it wanted, very quickly a system, the government said, you know, we've got to figure out a regulatory way. And so Hollywood very cleverly said, we'll regulate ourselves. And that was the Hays Code. And so the Hollywood studios got together and appointed their own regulator and essentially regulated themselves, applied their own system of censorship and applied their own code to motion pictures. And this was a way to stop the government doing it. And we've seen that same style of self-regulation then spread to every other industry basically in the entire world, you know, because anyone making anything would rather tell themselves what to do than have the government tell them what to do.
Oh, okay. So is the Hays Code basically means it's if it's an R+, it's got a really juicy sex scene, like that's way before that.
It's way before that.
Just about
that.
What they could show.
Yeah, it's way before that. That's sort of a system of government ratings that came in afterwards,
and that's so got violence and everything as well. Yeah.
So until the regulation, the self-regulation of films, people. The Hollywood studios and other countries making films were allowed to show whatever they wanted. And so what you'll find if you go look at pre-Hays Code footage, for example, is you're not going to see unsimulated sex. I mean, I'm sure that people were pointing cameras at sex from the dawn of time and making amateur pornography from the very beginning. I'm sure that happened, and I'm sure those films exist, although, you know, a lot of early footage is lost, most of it's lost. But what you do see in pre-Hays Code films, for example, is the naked female chest, breasts, basically. Mm-hmm. That was around. That was in mainstream films, projected on cinema screens, and people were getting, you know, titillated by that and laughing and cheekily and all of this. And then that stopped. And, I mean, you just can't imagine a Hollywood film. Like, you can't imagine a Warner Brothers film from 1949 showing naked female breasts, can you? It just – so when we think of old movies, we think of them as chaste because we forget about this period before
beforehand.
The early 1930s.
Okay, so that was like 1930 to 1968 they used the Hays Code.
Yeah.
Okay. But, of course, it's different across cultures as well, because in India, when I was living in India, I'd be like, my gosh, they never kiss. They have wet saris, they're clinging, they're dancing in the rain, they come so close to a kiss, but then they never see a kiss because it's quite a private act in India.
And that's really fascinating to me too. I mean, I'm not an expert on Bollywood films, in the slightest, and a lot of people are. But that's fascinating to me about the wet sari versus the kiss thing because, of course, in 1939 in Hollywood, every film had a kiss. You were kissing, everyone was kissing everyone all the time. That was their way of portraying sex. But the idea of showing someone in a wet sari, they wouldn't show that. You know what I mean? Yeah. That would be way too much.
It's all different, isn't it, across different cultures.
Yeah.
And, you know, early German films were outrageous. And so we're sort of talking mainly about mainstream films tonight that would come to Australia, but a lot of them made in America and Europe, which is probably less conservative than Australia and America.
Well, outside of – so you've got the reason – besides erotic cinema, the reason I've got the word mainstream in there is outside of pornographic films, you know, for the X-rated market, for the underground market, there have also always been experimental films. So, for example, Andy Warhol made in his factory a sexually explicit film where people actually had sex, but that – wasn't released in cinemas to go see on four different sessions throughout the day. You know what I mean? So that's an experimental film. So we won't really talk about those either. Mm-hmm. But you do find the dam starting to break, obviously, in the 1960s. You know? Along with everything else, cinema followed
the 60s.
The revolution, the sexual
summer
revolution.
Of love, 67, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So you find it happening all over the world. But of course, as night follows day, it started in Europe. And it kind of started in Scandinavia, really. That's where you first start seeing much more sexually explicit material going onto mainstream screens in countries like Denmark and Sweden. And the first big breakout international film that showed what everyone basically could swear was sex, it was so well done, was a Swedish film called I Am Curious Yellow, which has sort of gone down in history as the one that sort of broke the walls of all the cinemas in other countries. And, of mm-hmm. course, it was considered art house, and basically any foreign film in those days in Australia or America or in England was considered a bit art house or artsy or, you know, continental. But that was sort of how chaste couples were able to sneak off to the cinema and see something, and I'm sure talk about it giggly at dinner, was the films from Sweden and Denmark and other parts of Scandinavia.
Yeah, they've got that reputation.
Yeah.
You're on Nightlife. We're talking about, what did you call it? Erotic mainstream cinema. With CJ Johnson. I'm already getting some texts coming in. Hysteria is erotica comedy. That's from Veronica.
Hysteria, I think I've seen that. I think, if I'm correct, I think that's the film about how psychiatrists used the vibrator to as a method of
Calming women's hysteria.
Yeah. And it's done as a comedy and it's quite clever.
It is quite funny, actually.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I believe that's Veronica. The film she's talking about.
Thank you. Body Heat, says someone else. Steamy Kathleen Turner.
Yeah.
Super sexy.
I want to get into that era. The early 80s and into the mid 80s was a real high point for this, because that's when basically Hollywood caught up and started trying to make you know, these sexual films, but they very often combine them with film noir or the thriller genre. And so that we get a lot of films like Body Heat and The Postman Always Rings Twice, the remake, and films that were simultaneously sold. And I remember being a kid and these sort of films being around. Obviously, I couldn't go see them, but I remember being fascinated by their posters and their marketing campaigns and all of this. And of course, as an adult, when I finally went and checked them out, they weren't nearly as lurid as my imagination. Of course.
Yeah, well, exactly. You can just imagine, you know, young kids in front of those. I remember seeing a little bit of it on telly. I was probably sneaking around the back of the couch. I was telling Rod that I used to do that when my parents watched Alvin Purple. I'd sort of hide behind the couch.
Alvin Purple. Alvin Purple was a 70s, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was Australia's attempt at a really, really,
TV
really
show.
Risque comedy.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
They were running around nude and all sorts of things were happening.
Well, I'm glad that we were up there early. I'm glad that
Yeah, totally. All right, people can text in with their favourites. The number is 0467922702, and we'll take some calls in just a moment. But, yeah, I think 70s films do seem more lurid now. We're kind of possibly going through a more conservative period. Again, it comes in waves, doesn't it?
It absolutely comes in waves. In the 70s, in the mid-70s, there were a batch of films, or a batch of four films that are considered game changers and kind of classics. And they've all aged very differently. The real big one was a Japanese film called In the Realm of the Senses, and it was more explicit than all the others that I'll talk about until we get up really to quite modern times. Indeed, it is possible that some of the stuff you're seeing on camera, on film, in that film is quote-unquote unsimulated. So the actors were actually doing some variation of sex, because the film is full of many, many variations of sex, and some of them might have been unsimulated, might have actually been happening on camera. And it was a very, very bold and provocative film. And it also has a very, very disturbing ending, which I won't get into here. But so it was a risque film and a very, very controversial film, and of course a film that people flocked to. So, and it went worldwide. You know, it was one of those breakaway international art house hits that went worldwide, and that reset everything, that film. And the fact that it came from Japan is really quite interesting, because Japan obviously has a long history of incredible cinema and has given the world all sorts of interesting genres as well, such as samurai cinema and all of this. But the fact that it was the first country to make this sort of breakthrough, unbelievably explicit film that also was a proper mainstream film with proper production values and a beginning, a middle, and end, and good acting, and all of this was interesting.
Okay, so that, and then what did that influence in terms of films here?
Well, around the same time, there was an excellent film that is a horror film, there's thriller, very A class, by Nicholas Roeg with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, called Don't Look Now. It's not a sex film, and it barely makes our list because it's not about sex. It's about a couple losing their child and getting scared in Venice by this sort of ghostly apparition of their child. But it does feature early on in the film a scene where Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie have sex, just as a married couple, very casual. They're just doing other stuff and they just start having sex. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was jaw-dropped. I remember saying to my parents, is that real? And for the longest time, those two actors were very coy about whether they actually did it or not, because it's very, 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 very believable. And I think that in the end, I think Rod was just telling me that Donald Sutherland actually finally said, no, actually, I think I've told you all for years that we did, but we actually didn't. And I think Julie Christie for a while said that they did. And maybe as she's gotten older, she said that they didn't, maybe because she's got grandkids now and she didn't want them to think they're grandma.
I kind of think if they actually do it, it's going into porn myself, but that's why.
Well, I think that's interesting.
It's going beyond imagination and simulation and acting into real life.
But I don't know. I don't know about if I agree with you about that. I think porn is in the eye of the beholder and in the eye of the distributor and in the eye of the government at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think it's actually defined
and
by whether or not you do it. Because,
it changes
for example,
over time. Yeah.
it's the screen. It's not the stage. For example, if you're playing a drunk scene and it's the last scene you have to shoot that day, you can get drunk. You know what I mean? Unlike in the theater, you just film it. If you're doing a sex scene to make it realistic, why not?
Well, but that brings up the whole, era we're living in at the moment, the whole Me Too movement, and a lot of these older films where it looked like people were actually having sex are now being interpreted in a very different way.
Which brings us to Last Tango in Paris.
Exactly. Okay, tell us this story in a way that's...
Well, Last Tango in Paris is essentially one of the first big breakthrough films along Within the Realm of the Senses, Don't Look Now, that period. But it happened to feature a massive major movie star in Marlon Brando. So, I mean, spectacular A-list, nominated for Oscars multiple times, all of this. I mean, Marlon Brando, considered the world's greatest screen actor, and here he was in this Italian sex movie. And basically, Romy Schneider, who played the woman in the film, years later has said, and only recently, only in the last few years indeed, has said again that she regrets the film, that she feels she was totally exploited, and that essentially Marlon Brando and Bernardo Bertolucci, the director, teamed up and abused their power on the set of that film. And it's
and had non-consensual sex with her, really, didn't he?
I suppose so. I'm not sure whether she's actually, has she actually accused that of happening?
I think that the director said, yeah, really do it and we'll film it and we'll get a better reaction. So, yeah.
Right, right. So it's got, I mean, that film is now the Harvey Weinstein of films, right? All of a sudden it's off the shelf, it's out of the conversation because, I mean, if that's what happened, then obviously that was something that was never meant to happen. You're talking about a crime while the cameras are rolling.
But it's all later, but she never said anything at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. You are on Nightlife. We're getting lots of calls, actually, about films. And CJ is going to tell us about how they film these scenes because I'm really keen to have that insight. But do you want me to take a call?
Yeah.
Darren's got a really good point and one you made. Well, because we're going to go through them in a different sort of way, but I just want to put Darren because he's been waiting for a long time.
Hi, Darren.
Hi, Darren.
Hi, CJ. Hey, Sarah. How are you?
Good. What's your favourite sexy film?
A funny little movie that gave us all the absolute pleasure, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It was all about that.
What it is about. You're absolutely right. That film is about sex and sexuality. No, you don't. It's so wonderfully chaste. I love that movie. I watch that movie every year.
Did you know that it saved Columbia from bankruptcy because people kept going to the midnight showings for years and years?
I'm sure. I have no doubt. I mean, that's an Australian film, essentially. That's Jim Sharman and Brian Thompson did the sets. And even though it was, I think, made in the United States or Britain and Tim Curry was the lead, it's essentially the main creative crew behind it were all Australian.
Barry Humphrey was one of the dancers at the start.
Oh, there you go.
What?
Are you sure?
He's one of the extras. The Time Warp dance, he's one of the people that come to see the experiment.
I guess
in the Time Warp dance? No.
Yes. One of the extras.
I guess that's entirely possible because, I mean...
I saw that film about 20 times. I used to dress up and go to it and, it became a piece of performance art. You'd get out water pistols and
I
never
noticed
that.
Can I say one thing, guys?
Yeah.
Give yourselves over to absolute pleasure.
Good on you, Darren.
Don't dream it, be it.
Oh, here's a little bit of the title song.
Outer space, and this is how the message ran. Science fiction.
Rocky Horror, which is a very sexy, it's a sort of a sexy romp.
It's a sexy
Isn't it?
Romp.
The whole
I mean,
film.
I love the Derek. pardon me. Rang up with that one because it is so chaste and cute and wonderful. But it is all about sex.
It's when you see it when you're young. It's not that chaste.
No, not at all. Not at all. And it's a celebration of sexual diversity. I mean, everything's in there. Yeah.
Yep. It goes in all directions. That one doesn't
Good
it?
Idea. I love that film.
So you mentioned the 80s again, and someone had said about the Body Heat film.
Yep.
But the 80s are a bit of a peak time. So you want to talk about some of the very famous 1980s sexy films.
Yeah, the 80s were a great time because mainstream cinema tried to be much more overtly sexy and sexual, and yet still, by our reckoning, was very chaste. I mean, especially in the 2000s, since the 2000s, things have taken a radical leap forward in terms of what people have been willing to show and what people have been willing to go see and not complain about. Not write to the letters to the editor about. But in the 80s, there was a lot of this steamy, sultry eroticism going on. The one that I really remember being obsessed by as a kid before I'd seen it, because I just couldn't fathom what could possibly be in this movie because it had such a reputation even before it came out, was 9 and a Half Weeks.
Oh, yes.
With Mickey Rourke and Kim Basinger.
Yeah.
And the
Everyone would talk about the fridge.
Everyone would talk about, yes, because in the fridge, because, you know, at one point they do stuff with food. Essentially, the plot of that movie is it's got a sheen. So she works in like an art gallery. She's an art gallery assistant and he's a very snappy dresser. I don't know if we ever find out what he does, but he's wealthy. That's another theme of these movies, like 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Wealthy guy, mysterious guy and cold. And she's attracted to him and he's into S&M. He's into a bit of dominance and submission and she gets into it. And that's basically
the 80s 50 Shades of Grey then.
It is, totally. I mean, 50 Shades of Grey does not exist without 9 and a Half Weeks. You know, this came 30 years before and was a prototype. And that's what the film is. And she gets into it and then you follow her sexual adventures throughout with him. And essentially by the end of the film, which I'm assuming is the kind of the end of 50 Shades of Grey, but I don't know, is she kind of realizes that once you've done all that with him and played, you know, all these games with him, that there's no there, that he's kind of a soulless, boring guy and she leaves him.
I don't know if that happens at the end of 50 Shades. Someone give me a spoiler alert on the text because I couldn't read the books and I didn't really want to see the film. But, well, yeah, she sort of becomes more empowered over the three films.
I think her journey there is to eventually wean them towards vanilla sex and away from the S&M.
Okay.
I think she marries him.
She marries him. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Come on. I know, ladies, you've read it because it was a time when I'd be walking around my suburb and I'd just be bumping into women because they were all
walking
and reading and not looking up. They're walking into lampposts.
Maybe everyone who's looking at their phones and annoying you on the street is reading 50 Shades of Grey on their phones. But 9 and a Half Weeks, when I finally saw it, it lived up to the hype for me. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a really cool version of a particular type of 80s shiny movie. Like, it's photographed really well. Mickey Rourke and Kim Basinger are really cool and well-dressed and sexy in their roles. The sex is, by 2000 standards, tame, but it's still well done. Like, there's heat between them. They had a chemistry, and it's hot. It's a hot movie, and I really, really enjoyed it. And unfortunately, it went to Mickey Rourke's head a little bit. So he kind of got into this vibe of being like scary, dangerous, sexy guy. And so he followed it up with a film called Wild Orchid, which is everything that went right with 9 and a Half Weeks. Everything went wrong with Wild Orchid. So you can watch 9 and a Half Weeks and go like, oh yeah, this is a sexy movie done right. And Wild Orchid is a sexy movie done wrong.
Okay, here's a little taste of Wild Orchid.
I'm not used to women running away from me.
And I'm not used to men in masks biting my neck.
I think you have me confused with someone else. That's not my style, Emily.
He looked like you. Felt like you.
How do you know what I feel like? Look, however I offended you, if I offended you, I'd like to make it up to you. I pick you up at noon. There's some places I'd like to show you. There's some things I'm sure you'd like to see.
Oh, does that get you excited on this Saturday
terrible.
Night?
And the thing about Mickey Rourke in those days, he was exciting. He was, you know, James Deaney, Marlon Brando-y. He was this sort of methody, Matt Dillon-y, sexy, tough, interesting, creepy, vaguely intelligent.
Did that for me. I think creepy is the word I'd use.
Well, yeah. He's creepy in that clip and in that movie. He's had a weird career, but he was a thing for a while. So in the United States, other films were happening at this time that were sort of trading on this marriage of eroticism and thriller. So Body Heat, you know, Kathleen Turner, yep. William Hurt, about a couple. And like, not only was it hot between them and there was heat between them, it was set like in a really stonking hot place, like Louisiana or something. Yeah. And everyone was sweating the whole time.
Very sweaty sex.
You needed to rub ice cubes on your own neck all the time, stuff like
There's those ice cubes again. Yep. We're getting some calls in. 1300 800 222 is the number if you'd like to say your favourite sexy film. Stu's got one. Hello, Stu.
Yes, hi Sarah.
What's yours?
Look, thanks for the topic. I'm enjoying it, but I was worried that the whole conversation might go a bit lowbrow, so I wanted to raise Steven Soderbergh's adaptation of Elmore Leonard's Out of Sight.
Terrific.
Which starred George Clooney in, I think, his first movie role. And Jennifer Lopez.
It's certainly very close to the beginning of his filmography, for sure. I mean, and probably his first big lead. Yeah, the scene in the car trunk, while nobody even so much as takes off a glove, is an unbelievably sexy scene,
yes,
isn't it?
I've seen it. It's really good. Yeah, they're in the back of the
trunk.
There's
a lot of jazz, and it's the great, jump cuts, and the facial acting is extremely sexy.
Yeah, that is a very sexy scene. And of course, Steven Soderbergh came into the spotlight, made his name by making a film before that called Sex,
yes.
Lies and Videotape.
Absolutely, yes. Very sexy as well.
Which got him into Cannes and shows you the power of even having the title word sex in your title. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yep, always works for you.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah, Out of Sight's a great film. Thank you.
I love Out of Sight.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks
Bye.
So much. 50 Shades... They both died due to an asteroid, thank God, says Michael in Sydney. Ha ha. Maybe people think they wish they did. But listen, it's sold millions. So, she did say that she was violated by Marlon Brando and called it rape.
Right.
Someone's texted in. So,
there you go.
Pretty horrendous.
Yeah, and I've never seen that film, thankfully. By the time I was ready to see it, its reputation had gone from being sexy to being boring, to being kind of a boring film. So around Body Heat, we've also got The Postman Rings Twice remake. So you've got all these films in the 1940s, noir, and they are sexy, but of course the Hays Code, all this, you can't show sex. So a lot of those get starting to be mined for remakes in the 80s and 90s, and now we're going to show you much more sexy content. So The Postman Always Rings Twice is an excellent noir from the 40s. Excellent. And the remake is Jessica Lange and Jack Nicholson. And it takes the original story, you know, a drifter goes by the roadside place and he starts having an affair with the woman who is married to the owner of the place. But it's Jack Nicholson, and I just could never buy that. Jack Nicholson, to me, he's always been a good actor. He's always been a funny actor. He's always been an intelligent actor, but I've never bought him as a sexy actor. Have you?
No.
No, he doesn't. I don't really see that. Whereas, of course, Jessica Lange, classically so.
Okay. All right. The Clooney-Lopez scene in the bar was hot, says someone on the text. Now, a few texts have come in saying Henry and June.
Yeah.
They're seriously erotic because that's the story, isn't it, of Anais Nin and
Henry Miller. Yeah.
So, yes, she's nominating that. And another texter coming in saying that they think the sex scene in Betty Blue was, they were really
having sex. Yeah, I'm pretty sure about that.
Yeah, this brings us to French modern erotic films. Yeah.
Just while we're on Henry and June, that's a really interesting one because that was late 80s,
set in Paris,
early 90s. Yeah,
but it's not French.
No, it was made by a guy named Philip Kaufman, who's an interesting director, and it is the story of Henry Miller and Anais Nin's relationship. And what was interesting about that film was that I was living in the United States at the time. That film came out as an NC-17. And NC-17 was this new classification that the American government came up with at some point when they didn't want to give a film an X, but it was too hard for them for an R. Because in America, R's you can still go see if you're under 18 as long as you're accompanied by an an over 18. That's what an R is in the United States. It's different to an R here.
Different here. Right.
So they had to invent NC-17, and they might have invented NC-17 for Henry and June, is my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing NC-17 being like, oh, I've got to go see this.
Yeah, well, if you want erotic novels, Anise Nin is incredible.
And Henry Miller, too, wrote a lot of sex books. Tropic of Cancer or Capricorn.
I don't find he's nearly as erotic.
Yeah, but it's a no-brainer, isn't it, for a film? Like, you know, these two sexy writers and their sexy affair.
Yep.
Yeah,
okay.
France in the 90s and 2000s started a new wave, a nouvelle vague of modern eroticism, and Betty Blue was right there at the beginning of that. There's no doubt. I mean, when we think of Betty Blue, we think of a sexy, sexy movie, a very French sexy movie. And I have read those same rumors/reports that there is unsimulated sex in that film, and it wouldn't surprise me. That kind of makes sense for that film. I mean, that film was an astonishing success around the world. It's kind of hard for us to remember just how...
Oh, everyone had the poster up in there.
Everyone had the poster. Oh, my God. Even people who hadn't seen the film had the poster. Yeah. Everyone had the soundtrack, and a lot of people had seen the film. I mean, that was a massive global box office smash.
And they were wearing blue and white tops and berets.
Gets quite dark, that movie.
I thought it's about mental illness as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. That's where it goes. But
okay.
It's also very artful and very beautifully shot and all of this. But after that, you've got a few films that are early boundary pushers. The films of people like Catherine Breillat. You've got films like Romance and Baisse-moi. And these are films that blur the line between simulated and unsimulated, in that essentially what you're seeing looks to your naked eye so unsimulated that it might as well be. So we're no longer talking about, essentially, we're no longer talking about the camera not pointing where it used to not point. So now the camera is starting to point there, and the trick is whether or not what you're seeing, such as the genitalia you're seeing, whether or not that is simulated.
Okay.
So there's this nether period.
Not letting anything up to the imagination.
Yeah. Yeah. Where they remove the shy camera. And so the camera's starting to point at the act, but the way they're getting around it is that the act itself is simulated. And then from there, we very quickly move into films where the act itself is unsimulated, even in mainstream cinema, even in films that are being released in, you know, at the Chevelle Cinema in Sydney or at the Academy Twin or, you know, in art house cinemas around the world. And this is where you get into this interesting thing about where and how and when what is allowed. And it really, I mean, I've been trying to figure this out my entire life because it's so confusing, because it really seems to come down to the individuals who serve on classification boards at any given time in any given country and nothing else. So there's
they're also feeding off the time and a mood in a country.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's, which I think is really interesting.
Exactly.
I mean, let's come back to certain films in just a minute. And I want to talk about how they make these things.
Sure.
So let's get down to the nitty gritty. Before they do that, I will quickly ask Diana hers because she's been waiting for a while. Hi, Diana.
Hello.
You wanted to nominate a film?
Yes, Picnic with William Holden and Kim Novak. They did a dance, and I think that was one of the most sensuous scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah, right. You don't need the sex. You just want the sexy dance. It's like,
no,
yeah, because you can use your imagination.
Together.
Mm-hmm.
I beg your pardon?
They had chemistry.
Oh, and how.
Brilliant. Okay. Thanks, Diana.
Okay. Bye.
In terms of actually filming them, Bob has called about a sex scene in what's the film, Bob?
Love Actually.
Yes. Because.
Yeah, and that it has an absolute, what would you call it, rainbow of top talent. And there's a couple of scenes in there where, what was his name, Martin Anderson is doing simulated sex scenes for a movie.
All right.
They're stand-ins for a pornographic movie, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Mm,
so, you know, and he ends up marrying this the other stand-in.
Yeah. They fall in love because he's got his hands all over and, yes, they're having...
Yeah, but he hasn't got the bits going, if you know what I mean.
Yes. All right. Thanks, Bob. Now that's a really interesting way. That's a really interesting way to get into the actual how they do it, because you've directed a sex scene in a film, yeah? So give us the insider's knowledge here. I keep hearing all these double entendres every time we talk tonight. Well, give us the insider's knowledge about how they actually go about shooting a sex scene. where they're not actually having sex.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's a whole bunch of different techniques at play here. The first one that's sort of the most famous, of course, is the clearing of the set. So you've got a closed set. And the idea is that when two actors are going to, or two or more, or sometimes one actor or actors are going to perform a sex scene, the first thing you do is bring the crew down to everyone but the very essentials. So that would mean a director, a cameraman, and a sound person. Camera person and a sound person.
Three people.
Three people. You can shoot a film for three people.
So it's more intimate.
Yeah, the director, the camera operator, and the sound operator. Yeah. So get everyone else out of there. Then, famously, infamously, a lot of times, supposedly this has really happened. To me, it strikes me as silly, but supposedly it happens all the time, is that crew will then get naked to make the naked people comfortable. Yeah, you've never heard of this?
No.
Yeah.
So the director stands there naked.
Yeah, they'll disrobe too, just because the actors are naked and just to make the room just feel like, look, we're all in this together, da-da-da-da-da.
We're all vulnerable.
Yeah, we're all vulnerable. We've all got our bits hanging out. Yeah. That's the thing, yeah.
But I thought people were wearing body stockings and
well, this is the thing. Then you get into accoutrements. So you get accoutrements that are body stockings, whatever. Essentially, genitalia cover-ups, basically, for men and women. And very often this is really more for the protection of the modesty of the performers than for the disguising of those things on screen. Because if you're going to cover genitalia up anyway, it's unlikely that the camera is going to be focused on it or pointed at it. And therefore, if you're not pointed at it, then there's no real reason to cover it except for the sake of the actors.
Well, and being sanitary, I would think.
So if you're seeing a sex scene in something that's where you're not actually pointed at it, the couple is essentially naked except for these things that are specifically designed for this purpose. Like, you would never use these things otherwise. You don't pair it with a bra and a fancy pair of heels and go out. You know what I mean? It's much more minor than that.
So listen to this. This is Michael Fassbender. No, sorry. This is Jamie Dornan, who was on 50 Shades of Grey. He says, your dignity is intact as much as it's all tucked away in a little flesh-coloured bag. As a guy, you put all your essentials in a little bag and you tie it up like a little bag of grapes and it's tucked away. Is that right?
What a cute description.
So
You've got these little bags, I suppose, and women have essentially, I believe it's referred to as essentially a wig of some variety.
A merkin.
A merkin, yeah. So you've got variations on merkins and and this is what can happen.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, of course, the actors can elect not to wear any such things if they wish, and it depends on how well they know each other and all of this, and hence you get situations where potentially Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, because it was 1973 and they were cool people and it was all groovy, might just have said, no, we'll just go for it. You know, film what you want. You know what you can and can cut in the editing room. You know what you can and cannot show. And so you do have films that come along, like British films, like Nine Songs that comes along, and a French film called Intimacy that come along where the actors just do it and it's shown and these end up on our screens and you're watching two actors actually have sex and there's no cutting in it and it makes it there. But you've got funny situations along the way, as we say, of merkins and things to deal with.
Things tied up in strings.
Things tied up in strings, as like a bag
are
of grapes.
These are a few of my favourite things.
And then you've got the secondary sort of humorous aspect of then replacing those things with representations of the real deal. So, for example, this is true, and I just want to phrase it properly for radio, live radio, that essentially oftentimes in film where you just simply see, in a sex scene or not, where you simply see a woman who is full frontally naked, particularly if they're a famous woman, an A-list actress that we all know and love, and they're fully naked, they might actually be wearing two layers of modesty protection. So they'll be wearing a merkin and then they'll be wearing another thing designed to make them appear naked, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Bizarre.
Yeah.
So you're not actually seeing them.
Yes, so you're not actually seeing, quote-unquote, them. You're seeing a representation of them.
I mean, the other thing is, what is it like? We tried to find an actor who'd talk to us about this tonight, but it's been a bit tricky to get someone. But, I mean, what is it like for them in the room and the experience? And because it must be so intimidating, I would think, and not that sexy, really. I mean, or Is it sexy? I mean, is there a fear that they'll get too turned on?
I directed a sex scene in 2006, I think, for a short film that I made, and it was called The Game. And it was predicated on this idea of there is this foursome who play board games, and two of them realize that their better halves are having an affair with each other. So they surreptitiously set up a camera and film them doing it. And then over board game night, they reveal to their effective two other partners that they know by showing them the tape. So what we had to do was we had to film the scene first that they were going to show them, so that when we filmed the rest of the movie and they showed it on the television monitor, that would already be done. So it meant that the very first shot I had to shoot of this like 4-day shoot was the sex scene. So it was like,
so this is
meet
John,
the actors.
This is Melissa. Yeah. Show hands, now have sex.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? Are you going, okay, now put your hand there and kiss her that way? And are you yelling out instructions, or do you let them just go for it?
The actors were Diana Glenn and Christopher Baker, both lovely, lovely people. And they were just so open and so cool. And it was really just about us hanging out for half an hour beforehand. Right.
Did you get naked?
No, I did not get naked. I don't think they'd met each other before. Right. So it was like getting them cool with each other. But they were very, very cool. And it was only from one angle, the scene, because it was meant to be a hidden camera anyway. And in fact, because it was a hidden camera, I could leave the room anyway. It was also quite an interesting position. So they were bold and brave. The trouble is when you get down to the kind of silly sex that really was rampant in the mid to late 80s, where Hollywood decided that if you weren't arching your back and like jutting out your chest and moaning and sweating, then you weren't having sex. I mean, the sex that you see in Hollywood
but
movies in the late 80s
it
is
would
ludicrous.
Be so embarrassing doing that.
Well, because those scenes were embarrassing and they were embarrassingly directed. Yeah. And those scenes, I really have heard silly reports of directors getting in there and calling from off camera, okay, now XXX, now YYY, now ZZZ.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just ludicrous. Whereas really the way to shoot a sex scene these days is to put up two or three cameras, shoot it for a while, and then Bob's your uncle and fix it in the editing room, you know. But in the 80s, they were going in for close-ups and this, and supposedly it was ludicrous. Like the scene of Top Gun. Go watch the sex scene of Top Gun. It's ridiculous, you know, or Basic Instinct.
Yeah. Well, Ashton Kutcher says that he likes to quote Sir Laurence Olivier when he has to do a sex scene. He says, when in doubt, I say what he used to say, which was something to the effect of, I apologize if I get aroused and I apologize if I do not get aroused. And you say it with the accent if you do it, and it makes the awkward state a lot better.
I apologize if I get aroused, but I also apologize if I don't get aroused. Now, Laurence Olivier, of course, famously suffered from premature ejaculation his entire life. And if you read his autobiography, which is called Confessions of an Actor, his big confession is his premature ejaculation. And almost every second chapter ends with him saying, and I would be satisfying Vivian were it not for my damned premature ejaculation.
That is just, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe Owen liked to shoot a sex scene with Sir Laurence Olivier. Lucky they weren't that raunchy at that time.
No.
Okay, yes, it doesn't sound like it's a very comfortable experience shooting a sex scene.
I can't imagine any actors particularly like it because it would be creepy if they did, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And just also vulnerable.
Yeah.
We are talking sexy films on Nightlife with CJ Johnson, and we've got lots of texts coming in with some other favourites. Jack Nicholson, you said you find hard to see sexy. He and Michelle Pfeiffer in Wolf. Very sexy, fabulous film, says Sally.
Yeah, that's I suppose, Jack Nicholson's Wolfman movie. It is famously kind of sexy. The Wolfman has always, always, always been a metaphor for man's unbridled lust, where, you know, that's what that Wolfman always is, kind of like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's when he turns into the wolf, he is unstoppable, insatiable, essentially, you know, a violent attacker. So that's an interesting one.
Quite a few people on the text line are saying The Big Easy, Dennis Quaid and Ellen Barkin. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one.
I think, once again, that's Big Easy. The Big Easy is New Orleans, isn't it? Isn't that what the Big Easy...
I'd say it's another 80s noir one, really.
Yeah, it's definitely that. But I think specifically that's the nickname of New Orleans, and almost any film set in New Orleans is meant to be, you know, a bit sexy. That's sort of America's sexy city.
Yeah, people in New Orleans are going, no, we're too hot. Okay. All right. We'll take a few more texts and a few more phone calls if you want to before the news. 1300 800 222 of your favourite sexy film that you will absolutely recommend. Let's talk about the United States of Sex and some of the other films that are not as kind of art housey and raunchy, I suppose, because they often sexy films kind of also coincide with coming of age, don't they?
And totally. I mean, when I was a kid, there were all these sort of teen sex comedies around.
And so many.
Yeah. But the one that's kind of started them all and also broke the barriers was this film called Porky's. I don't know if you remember Porky's. Porky's is...
shocking.
I'm sure it's terrible now if we watched it now. But it had its place in time as this sort of infamous movie, because it went overboard in terms of what it showed, and people were kind of jaw-dropped.
American Pie, kind of like that.
American Pie came very much in its wake, probably 15 years later, and American Pie kind of reinvigorated that particular genre, but on a much more chaste level. Like Porky's was much more explicit than American Pie. Mm-hmm. American Pie was kind of the sex comedy that everyone, you know what I mean? And you're right, it does come and go in waves. Things, the use of eroticism in cinema has ebbed and flowed, and there have been periods closer to our period now that have been more chaste than periods further away. You know what I mean? It is weird how occasionally everyone gets a bit more puritanical for a while and then becomes more progressive or open-minded. I want to mention there have been a few films that are totally films, quote unquote, about sex, about sexuality, that are very sexy movies, which barely depict any sort of outrageous sex at all. For example, Secretary. Do you know the film Secretary?
I have not seen Secretary. I've heard a lot about it, though. Tell us about it.
It's a charming film about James Spader is like the wealthy, successful white guy, just like 9 1/2 weeks, just like 50 Shades of Grey. And Maggie Gyllenhaal becomes his secretary, and they discover a mutual affection for S&M once again, just like the others.
This film just keeps getting made every 10 years,
yeah,
doesn't
totally.
It?
Yeah, totally. But it really works into their occupation because she's his secretary.
Oh, gosh. All right, here's a taste of Secretary.
Now, I want you to bend over the desk so you're looking directly at it. Get your face very close to the letter and read the letter aloud.
I don't understand.
There's nothing to understand. Put your elbows on the desk. Bend over. Get your face close to the letter and read it aloud.
Oh, there's a fine line between sexy and creepy.
You know, that makes the film sound unbelievably creepy, and it's so not.
Isn't it?
You know, it's actually a very charming... I kind of think it might even be a comedy, but it's charming. It's a rom-com. It's a rom-com with whipping. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. It's lovely. I recommend it.
Someone says Stanley Kubrick in the nude. I can't unthink that. Mark from Brighton. You said that the director sometimes gets naked.
I'm fascinated that Mark from Brighton mentioned that, because Stanley Kubrick famously went out on a sex movie. His final film was Eyes Wide Shut, which was his sex movie. That was Stanley Kubrick deciding to make the mother of all sex movies.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah. So it's about at the beginning of the film.
Bondage party thing.
Yeah. Mm. So at the beginning of the film, it famously had Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, who were married at the time. And famously, they worked with him for longer than like anyone ever had on a film, like 18 months nonstop shooting. Pardon me. And so at the beginning of the film, she gets flirted with at this very expensive sort of charity ball by a wealthy Italian count or something. And that gives her a sexy dream that night. And so the next night she confesses to her husband in the film, played by her husband in real life, Tom Cruise, that she had a sexy dream. And because of this sexy dream, he gets obsessively paranoid and embarks on this dark journey where he ends up at this English manor out in the countryside where these weird people have these masked orgies.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous, but it's very beautifully shot.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, let's take a couple more. Beverly.
Oh, hi. Hi. Hello there.
Hi, Beverly.
Hi, it's CJ. You haven't, unless when I was talking to you, the producer, Al Pacino. Has anyone mentioned him tonight? I think Al Pacino was, not for the last, say, 20 years, the most sexiest man in movies. Well, and Heat, there is a scene in Heat with an actress who I can't remember her name. I've only seen her once or twice before. She looks very French.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up now. I mean, I remember that scene. It's a very good scene, isn't it?
The most amazing scene, and it was an incredible movie, even though it was incredibly violent, which I hate.
Wow. Okay.
I hate guns. But Ellen Barkin and Al Pacino in... Was
Sea
it
of
Frankie
Love?
And,
Sea of Love.
Yeah. Nolene's mentioned that on the text line.
They were Frankie and Johnny in it. Is that the one?
No, Frankie and Johnny was a different one he did with Michelle Pfeiffer. But
right, no one.
Ellen Barkin was Sea of Love. Yeah, that's right.
Sea of Love.
That was another of these films that was marketed, that was essentially constructed as an erotic thriller.
Very erotic, wasn't it? Ellen Barkin was a very sexy lady.
Yes.
I mean,
I'm a straight, gal, but she...
I'm with you, Beverly. She's
you are?
Hot.
Yes, you, know what
betcha.
I mean.
Yeah, I do.
But Al Pacino, I don't think, as a straight woman,
best
Al Pacino,
topic
in his
ever.
In his day, for many decades, he was the great lover.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, then you've got to check out Al Pacino's his outlier, Cruising from 1980. Do you know the film Cruising? Al Pacino goes undercover as a leather queen in the meatpacking district in New York City. Yeah,
I've never seen it. No,
it's Cruising. Intense. William Friedkin. Yeah, it's worth seeing because it is easily the most sort of sexual content filled Al Pacino film, and it's a very interesting film.
Oh, thank you for that. I'll try and look it up.
But Ellen Barkin ain't in it.
No, no. If he's cruising in the meatpacking district,
yeah, no
I'd
Ellen
say
Barkin.
There's leather chaps and no, not many, not many ladies. Thanks, Beverly.
Thank you,
Beverly.
George, very quickly. George, quickly.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. What would you recommend?
I don't see a lot of movies, but I did see one quite some time ago, and it was a movie called Friends. And it was about some adolescent children. One was from a miner's family, very well-to-do, and he ran away with a young lady, and they found a cottage somewhere, and they reenacted a wedding, and they...
Oh, I've never heard of it.
It's one of the most erotic movies.
You've ever seen? I hope they were legal age. That's the main thing, right?
Yeah, well, they were, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It was a proper movie. It wasn't.
All right. Thank you for your call, George. We could talk about this all night.
I've really had a fun time. I've laughed a lot more
so
than
fun.
When we were talking about sci-fi.
Yes. Oh, dear. I'm going to dream about Al Pacino tonight. So many people are coming in about Sea of Love at the last minute, actually. It seems
to be that was famously a raunchy hot movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That Ellen Barkin.
Yeah. If you had to recommend one that people wouldn't have seen, it's too hard to do to you, isn't it, really? But... not 50 Shades, but
no,
maybe we should all watch Sea of Love.
Very, very quickly, I'm going to recommend one of the most sex-positive, friendly, fun movies of all time, really. It's a film called Short Bus.
Okay.
If you've ever seen Short Bus, that's worth seeing.
All right. CJ Johnson, you can hear him on Nightlife with Phil, and we love chatting to him on a Saturday night. We'll do Killer Animals one day. It won't be nearly as fun.
You're with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.